You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In 1985, Larry Youngblood was found guilty of raping a 10-year-old boy, and he spent 9 of his next 15 years in prison. But, in fact, he was innocent, and DNA evidence conclusively proved that in 2000. Why was Larry Youngblood charged at all, and why wasn't he freed earlier? Well, in Does an Innocent Man Have the Right to Be Exonerated?, feature article on the Atlantic magazine's website, Mark Bookman, director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation and a former public defender, examines how Larry Youngblood's case and other similar cases can go wrong, and I'm pleased it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Larry Youngblood was charged with attacking a 10-year-old boy named David Leon on October 29, 1983. What were the circumstances of the attack, and where did it take place?
Well, David Leon was a young boy, 10 years old. He was at church with his mother. The church was in a sort of a mall area, and in the parking lot of that mall was a carnival. So David Leon, not surprisingly, wanted to go to the carnival rather than be at church, and apparently snuck out, at which point he met someone who, you know, ultimately took him away from the carnival, sexually abused him, and then returned him back to the church some hours later. Mr. Youngblood was arrested, maybe a month later. He fit a general description of the perpetrator. He had a bad eye, so he was a black man with a bad eye, and he was arrested, prosecuted, and convicted.
Did he have any history of getting in trouble?
He had a minor history of scuffles, but he had no history of this sort of sexual abuse at all.
Now did he know David Leon or have any connection to him? Why did the police suspect him other than the fact that he had a bad eye?
I think that was that he had no connection to David Leon at all. He was he fit the description in Tucson, Arizona, and I think that the main reason he fit the description was in fact that he was a black man with a bad eye. He generally fit the description that young Mr. Leon had put out, and so they developed the identification that it was in fact Larry Youngblood, and David Leon did in fact identify him, although it was pretty tentative. He saw Mr. Youngblood for the first time. He identified his photograph. We don't really know the circumstances of that identification, but at some point shortly thereafter, he sees Mr. Youngblood at his preliminary hearing, and he leans over to the detective and says, "You know, is that him?" So, you know, that should have tipped off someone that maybe Mr. Leon was not certain in his identification. But nonetheless, Mr. Youngblood was identified, arrested, and convicted.
Could he have been convicted if David Leon hadn't testified as a 10-year-old eyewitness?
He could not. That was the evidence against him, was that identification and the fact that he generally fit the description.
Now, eyewitnesses can often be unreliable. What's the prevailing view among lawyers, whether they're prosecutors or defenders, regarding eyewitnesses?
Well, you know, more and more we're learning that eyewitness identification is really frail. And the one way we know this for certain is, you know, we look at DNA exonerations. And there are, you know, at this point, we have a body of work to examine. And when we look at those DNA exonerations for people that were clearly innocent and yet convicted, we see a shockingly high percentage, I think 70-something percent of those cases involved mistaken identification. This is something that really, I think, should be intuitively obvious to most people. I mean, everyone has had the experience of approaching someone who you know and you've known for years. You may have gone to school with that person and been in class with that person for years, and a few years later you see him or her in the airport, and you go and you touch their shoulder and you say, "Hey, Joe," and sure enough, it's not Joe. And you've made a mistaken identification of a person that you've known well for years. So think about the possibility of misidentification, you know, under traumatic traumatic and very, very quick circumstances. And that's what happens many times.
How did Larry Youngblood respond to the charges? Was he offered a plea?
Well, I don't think it was. Mr. Youngblood always maintained he was innocent. I was not Mr. Youngblood's attorney, obviously, but he always maintained he was innocent. I don't think that there was a deal that he would have accepted because he hadn't committed this you know, pretty heinous act. So he you know, right up until the end, he claimed after he had been convicted that the only reason he was convicted was because he was a black man with a bad eye that he in Tucson, and he just that's why he felt that he was convicted, and that's why in retrospect he was convicted.
How good a defense did he have? Did he have a public defender?
He had a public defender. I mean, the case was pretty zealously fought. In fact, the first jury, he went to trial twice. The first jury was hung. They did not reach agreement. So, you know, the evidence was this young boy, a young 10-year-old boy. I'm not going to say that his representation was ineffective. The bottom line was that the police did not preserve the crucial evidence that would have shown the world that Mr. Youngblood was innocent. And that ultimately is I think, what the story is all about.
So the police didn't follow proper procedures?
Well, no, they didn't. And they should have preserved, you know, in any kind of a rape case, there's a rape kit that's taken, and you take swabs of you know, private areas, and those are supposed to be, you know, they're preserved, they're put in a refrigerator so that they can be subsequently tested. In this case, a lot of the potential DNA was not preserved properly, and so it went bad. It was not refrigerated. And that was the issue that, you know, ultimately went to the United States Supreme Court, that the failure to preserve necessary evidence.
Didn't Larry Youngblood have an alibi?
He did. In fact, his alibi, you know, oftentimes alibis are hard. It's hard to win the day with an alibi. And many times you're not anywhere special. You know, it's not like you're always clocking into a money machine or you're making some sort of a public speech. A lot of times you're just home with someone in your family. And so in this case, he had an alibi, but he was arrested, I think, 42 days later, and he was home at the time with his kind of on-again, off-again girlfriend. So, you know, it was not a compelling alibi. Even though he didn't do it, he just happened not to be at the carnival. But sometimes, you know, it's not so easy to prove your innocence.
My guest is Mark Bookman. He is the director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. His article, "Does an Innocent Man Have the Right to Be Exonerated?" is in the Atlantic. Larry Youngblood appealed. What did he argue? This is a case that went up to the Rehnquist Supreme Court.
Yes. The main argument he made was that the state had an obligation to preserve this evidence. You know, what the case ultimately came down to, and I guess I should take a second to say the Supreme Court has never admitted this was a mistake. In fact, this Arizona versus Youngblood, which is the United States Supreme Court case, is still good law to this day. They have not changed their mind on the policy. And here's what the policy ultimately was. You know, either we look at whether the state tried to prevent a fair trial, or we look at the question of whether the accused actually got a fair trial. What the Supreme Court said was the state did not try to prevent a fair trial, and therefore we're not going to grant relief to Mr. Youngblood because the state didn't do anything intentionally wrong.
Can I quote from the majority opinion? It
absolutely
actually said, unless a criminal defendant can show bad faith on the part of the police, failure to preserve potentially useful evidence does not constitute a denial of due process of law.
That's exactly right. That's how they ruled. And of course, the dissent said, look, the bottom line is not whether there was some good faith attempt at a fair trial. The bottom line is, did the man actually get a fair trial? And, in this case, pretty glaringly, Mr. Youngblood didn't get a fair trial. And it's ironic, you know, almost beyond belief that in this particular kind of case where the court rules the state does not have an obligation to give someone a fair trial necessarily, that he happens to be innocent. He turns out to be innocent. That's one of the great ironies, I think, of Supreme Court case law.
Harry Blackmun, William Brennan, and Thurgood Marshall dissented, but surprisingly, John Paul Stevens didn't. He concurred, although he filed a separate opinion.
Yes, and, you know, I have to say, I'm a huge fan of Justice Stevens. I think he's one of the greatest Supreme Court justices of the last 50 years. But, you know, you don't hit every pitch that's thrown to you, and I think he just missed this one. He said he disagreed with the majority. He said, you know, sometimes we have to look at whether the person actually got a fair trial. But in this case, it doesn't really matter. You know, Mr. Youngblood, as I wrote, Mr. Youngblood just appeared guilty. So I think Justice Stevens just kind of missed the ball on this one time.
And you note that the Supreme Court has favorably cited Arizona versus Youngblood three times. When was the last time? And what was that all about?
That case was a situation where a man, Mr. Thompson, was improperly imprisoned on death row for 14 years. The jury returned a $14 million verdict in his favor for misconduct by the prosecution. And the court reversed that. The United States Supreme Court reversed that, saying that, you know, it was they weren't intentionally doing it. It was intentional, but it wasn't systemic. In other words, you can't blame the entire district attorney's office for it. And so you know, this was a one-time failure to reveal exculpatory information. And so we're not going to allow this suit to stand. And they reversed it. And then a few of the justices said that under Youngblood, the exculpatory evidence didn't clearly have to be turned over in the first place. So they, you know, they're maintaining under Youngblood this concept that the state does not have to ensure a fair trial as long as they don't act in bad faith, you know, let the chips fall where they may.
Does that give police or others an incentive to be careless, an incentive to turn a blind eye to accidents?
It certainly doesn't give them a disincentive. And you know, I think if the case law had come down as a lot of people advocate, which is that the state really has an obligation to make sure that evidence is preserved, to make sure that the accused really does get a fair trial, then there'd be a huge disincentive for the state to mess up the evidence, to not preserve it properly, because then, you know, there would be a remedy for people that are accused, whether they were innocent or guilty. And so the state would have a real incentive to make sure they preserved evidence properly. With Arizona Youngblood, I have to agree, there's no overriding incentive to make sure that they preserve every bit of evidence that they can.
Given the Supreme Court rulings, how are prosecutors or police to be held accountable when it's not possible to prove deliberate, intentional misconduct?
You know, that's a
situation
question.
Where the NYPD destroyed massive amounts of evidence in 1992.
Yes, there's many situations where evidence is destroyed. Now there are some. I also cite a case from Virginia where. They had just passed a rule saying, you know, you got to preserve evidence in capital cases, especially until all process is completed. And they violated that rule, and the courts did not remedy it. The governor had to step in and say, this just isn't right. I'm going to commute this person's death sentence to life imprisonment because they failed to preserve this evidence. So there is a lot of dumping of evidence, and There is a number of legislatures who I think are at least trying to prevent that sort of dumping, you know, through legislation. But the courts have not yet made this a constitutional requirement.
In the case of the NYPD destroying massive amounts of evidence in 1992 because they said they were running out of warehouse space, you argue the timing was a bit suspect.
Yes, I mean this happens a lot. You see it not only in New York but in a number of other places where you know, people are free, DNA exonerates someone, and so you know, it's not easy to admit you made a mistake. In fact, what I wrote was, you know, the United States Supreme Court does not apologize for its mistakes. You know, the police and the prosecution are not very likely to apologize for their mistakes either. So, you know, when you see an exoneration and you're thinking you've got all this evidence here, you know, maybe that's a good time to not go through, you know, thousands of possible exonerating evidence. You know, I don't think anybody wants to make a specific claim that that's intentionally done. But like you said, there's no disincentive to it. Let's just put it that way.
My guest is Mark Bookman, who is director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. He's a former public defender, and we are talking about what he's written in an article called "Does an Innocent Man Have the Right to Be Exonerated?" It is in the Atlantic. We will continue after this. We're back with Mark Bookman, a former public defender and now director of the Atlantic Center for Capital Representation. His article, "Does an Innocent Man Have the Right to Be Exonerated?" is in the Atlantic magazine's website. What happened after the Supreme Court's ruling in Arizona versus Youngblood? How was Larry Youngblood finally exonerated?
Well, it turns out he goes to prison eventually, and he spends five more years there. He's basically in and out during the appellate process. At some point, he loses in the United States Supreme Court. It goes back to Arizona. The Arizona lower court then says, "Well, we're going to give Mr. Youngblood more protection than the United States Supreme Court does. We think that he did not get a fair trial, so we are going to find that he cannot go to prison." Then the Arizona Supreme Court takes the case and reverses the lower court. So now Mr. Youngblood has exhausted any appeals he has. He goes to prison. He gets out after some years. And then he goes back to jail because he violates kind of a technical ground of his parole by not reporting. Now that he goes back, the DNA has actually made improvements. So what was bad evidence is now good evidence. So his lawyer then says, "Look, let's test what we have now because we've made advancements in DNA." Sure enough, they test the DNA, and it turns out he's innocent. So by fluke, really, the only way we found out he was innocent was the fact that he went back to jail for a parole violation. He gets set free, and at that point, no one is in custody for this crime. In fact, ironically, the only person that's in custody is the victim, who has now grown up to be an adult and assaulted his girlfriend and went to prison. So the only person in jail for some time is David Leon. Mr. Youngblood is out. And there's no one that's been arrested. Finally, they run the DNA in a data bank, and they find that it hits a man named Walter Cruz, who is in a Texas prison. And sure enough, he fits the description as well. He has a bad eye. I'm sorry, he's a black man with a bad eye, and he has a history of sexually abusing children. One final fact, which is really remarkable, is that he also had a similar arrest in Tucson for this kind of behavior as well. But it, you know, the police just missed it.
They just didn't even look at their own records. They just simply settled on Larry Youngblood and committed totally to him?
I think that's right. I you have to assume that if they saw a sexual assault crime committed by a black man with a bad eye, they would have at least considered him a possible suspect over Mr. Youngblood, who had the bad eye but had no history of such sexual misbehavior.
Before DNA retesting was allowed, Youngblood had to commit bindingly not to sue the county attorney, the police, or the State Department of Corrections. Couldn't officials be forced to retest the DNA without that agreement? Could that requirement count as a kind of official extortion?
Well, it was official extortion, and frankly, you see this all the time. In this case, they were still threatening put Mr. Youngblood under trial. I mean, he was not necessarily going to be freed. They did sort of extort him to make sure he wasn't able to sue anyone. We see this pretty regularly in cases where relief is granted. It's pretty clear that the person is innocent. It may not be absolutely positive, but it's pretty clear. And the state or the Commonwealth will, you know, insist on a guilty plea of some sort to let someone get out of jail quicker. You know, I think your phrase official extortion is a pretty good one.
How did David Leon's family respond either during the 1988 appeal or when the better DNA techniques proved that Youngblood hadn't committed the crime?
Yeah, I think the real untold story a lot of these times is, you know, the trauma to the victim. In this case, not only was Mr. Leon a victim of a horrible crime, but then he kind of gets victimized again by his own misidentification of Mr. Youngblood. But I don't blame Mr. Leon. He's a 10-year-old boy. I'm sure he's obviously doing his best. But the state doesn't do a very good job of making sure they have the right person. So Mr. Leon is victimized again when he realizes he's got, not only did he put the wrong person in prison for years, but the right person has remained essentially free
for 17 years
as well. Yeah. So they took it very, very poorly.
Now, what happened to Larry Youngblood after he was freed? Could he sue? Was he compensated at all for the years he'd spent in prison and had to struggle with the legal system?
He wasn't compensated at all. He died homeless on the streets, essentially. He had mental problems. There was a final irony when before he died, he was arrested for kind of pulling a knife on a subway employee. I think sort of a kind of a homeless type of crime. I don't really know how serious it was, and I suspect it wasn't very serious. But while they were out looking for Mr. Youngblood, they instead arrest a man named Julian Kinney, who is the head of Africana Studies at the University of Arizona, I think. And he, you know, they arrest him because he fits the general description of Mr. Youngblood. And Kinney then says, "Look, the only reason I got arrested was because, you know, I fit a general description." He says, "Never before have I experienced such humiliation and degradation. My human and civil rights were violated solely on the basis of my skin color." So, you know, kind of a final irony that someone, the police looking for Mr. Youngblood, end up arresting the wrong person who just looks vaguely like him.
A listener, David from Paramus, says, "An innocent defendant has no way to look not guilty. There's no facial expression that says not guilty."
He is so right. When you're sitting in the dock, as they say, you know, anything. I mean, for the presumption of guilt, you know, we talk about presumption of innocence all the time. But anyone that does this work knows that there's a presumption of guilt. You know, the first thing anyone does when they walk into a courtroom is they look at the defense table to see who the criminal is, right? Not who the accused is, but, you know, who did the crime. So it's, there is a presumption of guilt, and that's why our system doesn't make you prove innocence. But nonetheless, you know, that presumption of guilt, it really weighs strongly on everybody.
Did any public officials admit mistakes of any kind in this case?
Well, what they said was, you know, we did everything properly. And it turned out, you know, basically it turned out Mr. Youngblood was innocent, but it wasn't our fault. We did everything exactly right. We did everything that was called for. That's obviously not an admission that they might have done things better. I think they were, even after signing all those releases by Mr. Youngblood, I think they were worried about being sued, and, you know, rightly so. I mean, if the Youngblood decision had said what a lot of people think it should say, which is the bottom line is not whether we can blame someone for an unfair trial. The bottom line is, did the accused get a fair trial? If that was, in fact, the bottom line, then Mr. Youngblood would have been compensated and the state would have apologized.
Mark Bookman's article, "Does an Innocent Man Have the Right to Be Exonerated is on the Atlantic Magazine's website. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We talk about the presumption of innocence, but haven't many suggested that some of the people currently on the Supreme Court, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito, suggested that and been ruling that the burden of proof is on the defendant's shoulders, not on the prosecution's shoulders?
Well, no. A fundamental tenet of our justice system is that you're innocent and the state has to prove you guilty. So there's no – the Supreme Court, changing that burden of proof. That's fundamental to our system of justice for many, many years. What I am saying is that saying that there's a presumption of innocence doesn't necessarily mean that there's a presumption of innocence. I mean, all of your listeners know – that when they hear some sort of scandal or other, they immediately assume that the scandal is accurate. They don't know any. They don't have any proof. They haven't seen any evidence. But it's just it's a human tendency to essentially presume guilt. So the Supreme Court is not changing that. It's just the burden of proof changes depending on the process and where you are in the appellate procedure. But we're not changing the presumption of innocence. It's just. It's not as hardy a presumption as it sounds.
You note,
that's what I'm saying.
You note that an Innocence Project report is that eyewitness misidentification is responsible for 72% of convictions that get overturned by DNA evidence. People are easily persuaded that they've seen something that they haven't, but the DNA evidence isn't always available in a case where there is an eyewitness identification.
That's the hidden secret, Leonard, that you just said, which is DNA evidence. You know, when we look at DNA evidence and we see exonerations, that's the tip of the iceberg. In the majority of cases, there is no DNA. So when we say, you know, there's a certain percentage of people who have been exonerated by DNA, there's a way bigger percentage of people that have not been exonerated, not because they're guilty, but because DNA is simply not available to them. That's the missing. You know, DNA is a window into our justice system. It is not our justice system entirely. It's just one way of looking at a certain percentage of the injustice that we now know exists, and we have a much better sense of that injustice than we had, you know, before DNA evidence. And I cite the example of Henry Lee McCollum, which Justice Scalia made a big point of saying that what a horrendous crime, and that after Justice Blackmun kind of famously said we won't tinker with the machinery of death, he won't tinker with the machinery of death any longer. Justice Scalia made a kind of a big point of saying, look at this Henry Lee McCollum case. You know, this is a total outrage. How can you feel that the ultimate punishment is not meritorious for such a horrendous case? 20 years later, in another remarkable irony, it turns out Henry Lee McCollum is innocent, and the DNA has exonerated him as well. So, you know, the irony just pervades this story.
According to the Innocence Project, between 2.3% and 5% of all prisoners in the United States are not guilty. What do you think of those estimates?
Well, I mean, you know, as a longtime public defender, I think that that's – I don't know how you – quantify it. I mean, it's not an easy thing to do. You can look at your error rate and make that determination. Certainly, it's a high number. And when you start, you know, using percentages, it probably helps to think of 100 people in a line, and then you pull five of them out, and you say, you know, these are five people that are going to go to prison wrongly. It would hit the average person as a huge number. The number might be as high as 5%. That's a big percentage.
You ask, to what lengths must the state go to ensure that the accused gets a fair trial? Well, how far does a state have to go?
Well, especially
with significant budget cuts in recent years.
Well, you know, there are budget cuts everywhere, but those budget cuts, trust me, they tend to fall much harder on the defense than they do on the prosecution. I think that the state has to be conscious of preserving all relevant evidence. Now, you know, I mean, it's not the easiest thing to predict what's relevant, but certainly if you're going to the trouble of taking, you know, a rape kit or saliva swabs or whatever, in this day and age, we know that a lot of things are subject to tests. So, you know, it doesn't serve anyone's purpose to send innocent people to prison. I think that we should put a certain percentage of resources into making sure that we're limiting our mistakes as best we can. I guess I'll put it that way.
Well, have we been spoiled at all by watching shows like CSI, where they have all this high-tech capability of checking out these things? That often is not the case in the real world.
Yeah, I don't think we've been spoiled, but we've been badly misled, I think, into thinking. I mean, you know, I think that juries are still misinformed about the reliability of eyewitness identification. I wrote another essay on the experience of false confessions. I think that we are very misinformed as to how often we have false confessions and how they are generated. So, you know, juries believe eyewitness identification, and they are skeptical when someone claims that their confession was false. I think we've been misled, you know, in both those areas. But as we learn more and as science develops, hopefully our justice system will develop as well, and we'll be able to inform juries that these mistakes are much more common than we were ever led to believe.
Wrongful execution has got some press with the cases of Cameron Todd William, who was executed in 2004, and Carlos de Luna, who was executed in 1989. But didn't Antonin Scalia insist that there's not been, and I'm quoting, a single case, not one, in which it is clear that a person was executed for a crime he did not commit?
Right. You're quoting him accurately. It's strange credulity in every possible way to think that we've caught every mistake, because we know that DNA has exonerated a certain percentage of people. That's, you know, beyond question. So the idea that we haven't executed an innocent person really does strain credulity, because it just makes sense that we would have, you know, regardless of Cameron Todd Willingham or anyone else. Our percentages tell us that we've made these mistakes. And even Justice Scalia, you know, in the McCollum case, you know, transparently made a very public mistake. So, you know, why he claims that this has never happened when it's, you know, right in front of his face, I don't know.
Mark Bookman's feature article in the Atlantic Magazine's website is "Does an Innocent Man Have the Right to be Exonerated?" Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me again. It was a great pleasure.